So my talk is called A Life in the Sangha. I have had a life in the Sangha, nearly 30 years. But I'm going to begin with something a bit unusual. In the middle of Amsterdam, there is a monument. And this monument is made of three large pink triangles. And this is a monument from the 1980s to all victims of homophobic discrimination and persecution. And on it, there is carved a line from a poem by a Dutch Jewish gay poet called Israel de Haan. And it says in Dutch, and I'll translate, such a measureless longing for friendship, or en sodan metles lengtan efter vennskap. Such a measureless longing for friendship. And this has been going around my head for the last few weeks since I decided to give this talk today. And I saw it many years ago, probably when it was new in the 1980s. And this line from the poem really stuck with me. And it stuck with me because I thought it was odd. I thought friendship might not be the first kind of longing you would expect to find on a lesbian and gay monument. You probably think of sex first, or human rights, longing for respect, or equality. But no, it says a longing for friendship. So I had to think about why would that be? Maybe it's about feeling alone with a secret. No, alone with nobody you feel you can really share who you really are. So when I was in my 20s, before I was in my 20s, when I was a child, I grew up in a boys' school. I grew up in a boys' boarding school just outside London on a very big hill. And it had about 750 boys living there. I lived there because my stepfather was a teacher. And it was a wonderful place. And I really loved it. It was very, very beautiful and it had the most fantastic view. But as you can imagine, if you're a girl, a boys' school is not a place that you can belong in. And I think I was quite alone, although I was surrounded by a very close network of a community, of school community of teachers and their families and the pupils. And in my 20s, I started to travel a lot. It was quite intriguing because on this hill, you could see for maybe, I don't know, 30 kilometres across London. Fantastic view. You could see there was a world out there, but we lived in this very closed little world. So when I was in my 20s, I went off travelling and I discovered something quite quickly, which is that when you travel in another culture, people can't read you. They can't read who you are. So you might not be able to hear this, but I have a very posh accent. So people in Britain, when they hear me speak, they can immediately think to themselves something about who I probably am and what kind of person I might be and where I come from and what my parents are like and which kind of school I went to. And this is probably not the same in Sweden, but it's very common in England. You can always tell something about a person from the way they speak English. At least which part of the country they come from. That's the same in Sweden, of course. But I discovered that when you travel, no one can work out who you are. They can't have any preconceptions about who you are. So who you are depends on conditions. And you can then, of course, have a feeling of yourself being different from who you thought you were because the conditions are different and because people are mirroring you back in a different kind of way. So it's very freeing. So I really like traveling and having this freer experience of myself. And later when I heard about Sangharakshita, about Bhante, how he went forth, how he left his normal life and went forth as a monk in India. And he burnt his passport. He and his friend burnt their passports. I thought, oh, I know what you're talking about. Yes, it's about people not being able to pin you down to a certain kind of person that you must be. It's a bit, his burning his passport was a bit more dramatic than what I did. I think you need a passport But it was some kind of insight I had that, you know, that who we are is not fixed, and that life isn't quite what it seems. I think I had a few insights as this traveller in her 20s. But one of the reasons I was travelling alone was that I had no idea how to get on with other people. So this was the downside. It's very enjoyable to travel on your own, and you have many adventures, and you might have more adventures than if you travel with someone else. But the fact was, I didn't know how to deal with other people. So I had no idea how to negotiate. I had no idea how to say what I wanted, or how to do what someone else wanted instead. How to compromise, and how to resolve disagreements and stay friends, or how to love, how to be loved, and certainly not how to love myself. So when I was about 30, I discovered Sri Ratna in London, and I discovered Sangha. And I'm sure that people do become friends in other Buddhist traditions outside Sri Ratna, but I don't think there's another Buddhist tradition where friendship and Sangha is the basic organizing principle upon which everything is based. I think that is unique to Sri Ratna as far as I know. So today we're celebrating Sangha Day, and Sangha, of course, is one of the three jewels. There's Buddha Day in May, and there is Dharma Day in July, and there is Sangha Day in sometime November, December. These days vary because they're always on the full moon. But today is the full moon, so this is the actual Sangha Day, although lots of Buddhists probably celebrated it at the weekend, like we did if you took part in the international celebration, because it's more convenient at the weekend. But it is actually today. And Bante said it was very important we should have three festivals that celebrate each of the three jewels. There is no festival common to all Buddhists. So we can't say that all Buddhists everywhere are celebrating Sangha Day right now. But quite a lot of Buddhists are, particularly in the Theravada tradition of South Asia. And this is the day when the lay people give new robes to the monks. So Sangha in that tradition means the monks. So Bante based our festival on that festival. But for us, Sangha is everyone, the whole of the Buddhist community. So all of us who place our trust or go for refuge to the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma and Sangha, to any extent are Sangha. We don't have lay people, and we don't have monks and nuns or priests. We just have Buddhists who are all going for refuge at varying levels of experience and commitment. And the word Sangha is quite interesting, actually. It shares the same root as sum in Swedish, i svenska, as in tillsammans and att samla, together, or to collect, or to gather. So Sangha is togetherness or gathering. That's what we're doing. We are being Sangha right now. We are Sangha-ing in English. I think it's interesting, looking at my experience, that Bante himself grew up very alone. You might know that he was alone in bed for several years as a child. So he had no friends as a child. And he turned that into a strength, because he realized he was a Buddhist when he was 16. But in Britain then, there weren't really any other Buddhists back in the 1940s, 30s. So there were no Buddhists to be friends with. So he had to teach himself, really, until he went to Asia, went to India and met lots of other Buddhists. And as we know, he was ordained as a monk in the South Asian Theravada tradition in the 1950s. But he decided to set up a new tradition, and he wanted it to be based on friendship. And I wonder how much that had to do with his own isolation as a child. And he was really very clear from the 1960s onwards that from his experience, most people were not going to make a lot of progress, spiritual progress, without the support of other Buddhists. it just wasn't going to be possible really to make a lot of progress by just studying it on your own. So having a teacher was really normal. Having spiritual friendship, sangha with people more experienced than you is really normal. But he identified pretty early on that most people would probably benefit in some ways even more from the support of people at roughly the same level of experience. That sometimes it might be quite hard to learn from someone who's a lot more senior than you, just because you feel such a difference between you, and you might feel respect and awe. Oh, gosh, they're so important. So it's really important that we spend time with people at roughly the same level as well. And he saw that the Buddha talked a great deal about the importance of Kalyanamitratta, so friendship, spiritual friendship, friendship between Buddhists, friendship based on a shared practice of the Buddha's teachings. And the Buddha talked about friendship many times. He listed a number of duties of friendship, things we could do for each other. I'm just going to go through them. There are nine of them here. He said the first one was generosity. The second one was kindly speech, kindly communication. Number three was looking after each other's welfare, taking care of each other, doing things that help others. The fourth is treating others as you treat yourself. And the fifth one is keeping your promises. So doing what you said you'd do. And he also said that friends are people who take care of us when we're sick. This is perhaps particularly significant right now when so many people are very ill. And they take care of our property, our things, and they are a refuge, a place of safety when we're frightened. And they don't abandon us when we're in trouble. So friends are faithful. So coming back to me, new in Sri Ratna, or in the FWBO as it was then, I went on retreats at Taraloka, and I went on working retreats, and then I worked at in a Buddhist business, the Clear Vision video project, for 17 years in a very large Buddhist center filled with different projects. There were something like seven floors in this Buddhist center, and each one of them had something different going on it. It was full of people, and I helped with painting the Buddhist center and cleaning it. And I lived in a women's community for 12 years. And in all these different situations, we did lots and lots of things together. And it was very intense, and we had a lot of fun as well. And there was a lot of rejoicing in merits. So any possible opportunity people had to celebrate someone's birthday or the anniversary of their ordination or whatever it is, we would take time to tell that person what we really appreciate about them, what's really good about them. And this was absolutely transformative. My life completely changed through this practice of people giving each other attention and reflecting me back to myself. The only problem was that sometimes it wasn't always that easy, because when people reflect you back to yourself, they don't always only reflect back the nice things. So I got lots of feedback, especially about my jokes. People sometimes didn't like my jokes. They said, "You're very funny, but actually sometimes your jokes are quite painful, a bit like a heat-seeking missile." So I had to learn that even though if communication is a strength, it can also be a weakness. And that was so painful, but they were absolutely right. So, but I just got so much out of this. I can't recommend it highly enough. So it's really obvious that before I encountered Buddhism at all, I had some insights into the nature of reality. I had seen that things are not what they seem, and I am not what I seem. But I had no context in which to explore these teachings or these insights. I couldn't make anything of them on my own, and there was no one to witness them in me either. And even if that aspect was quite well developed, other aspects of myself were completely underdeveloped, completely unbalanced. I really needed other people. And I think it was great that I came to be part of a very broad system of practice in order that I could develop all sides of myself. So not just looking at the nature of reality, but also looking at becoming more integrated, more psychologically integrated, through meditation and through being witnessed by other people who seemed to accept all aspects of myself and really wanted to know more about, really wanted me to show more about who I was. And I think it's really interesting that the Buddha didn't actually teach wisdom or insight as the thing to start with. He doesn't start with that. He described his very complete path in a number of different ways. But the simplest way he described his path was a path of three parts, which are ethics, meditation, and wisdom. So the first part was ethics. And there's really no better way to learn ethics than surrounded by people who reflect you back to yourself and who show you when they mirror back to you the effect you have on them. Otherwise, it's all theoretical. It just stays at the level of theory and ideas, what we should do, what we should be like. It was only through being with people, in friendship, close to people, and also if you have a partner, you'll do that also with your partner or husband or wife. And I think you really need to do that at the same time as developing wisdom in order for it to be a complete and well-rounded path, to develop all aspects of ourselves at the same time. So I'm talking a lot in terms of people actually being physically together and working together, living together. But ironically, actually, I think that Triratna is probably the one Buddhist movement in the world that uses the internet more than any other Buddhist tradition, as far as I know, even before COVID-19. But it's all in the service of Sangha and togetherness. So going back to that line of poetry on the monument in Amsterdam, such a measureless longing for friendship. So, you know, longing which is so deep you can't actually see how big it is, you can't measure it. No one knows how big it is. And I talked about at the beginning about the aloneness that comes with having a secret. So I was thinking about this in Sangha terms. I wonder if we could say that a Sangha is a people who have a longing, a people who long, and a people who share a longing which isn't easy to admit to, because people might laugh at you, or it might be so sensitive you don't want to just tell anyone about it. Just you might keep it to only to trust certain people with it. But maybe we share a longing which is to belong and to be seen and to be appreciated, but also a longing for meaning. And it would be really good if we, as Sangha members, could meet this longing in each other, particularly now, because the world, we and the world are in such a mess right now. We're in deep trouble. So if we go back to some of the advice that the Buddha gave for friendship, we could perhaps remind ourselves to be generous with each other and to speak kindly to each other. But that doesn't mean avoiding difficult conversations. One of the ways you build a Sangha is by still having the difficult conversations, but staying kind, staying open. And let's look after each other. Let's take care of each other when we're sick. And let's comfort each other when we're afraid. And let's really not abandon each other in this time of separation. It's quite easy to, especially when we don't get to go to the Buddhist center and be together, it's somewhat easy, I think, to start to feel a bit separated from each other, even with Zoom. And, you know, we're in the middle of the winter darkness, but we can all take care of the light of meaning and kindness. Thank you.